For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Matt Ardill, welcoming you back to the Comedy Album Book Club. Last month, we had a great conversation about Lenny Bruce's The Carnegie Hall concert with comedian Andrew Lazar. Unfortunately, one of our guests was not able to join us and had to reschedule. It turned out to be a gift because that gave me the opportunity to talk about this seminal piece of comedy history, not once, but twice, with two awesome people. I sat down with writer, comedian, educator, and activist Lara Ray to discuss the album, as well as their firsthand experiences talking to people from Lenny's life. So sit back and enjoy this second deep dive into Lenny Bruce's The Carnegie Hall Concert, this time with Lara Ray on the Comedy Album Book Club. Welcome to the Comedy Album Book Club. Today I'm joined by Lara Ray, playwright, Canadian Comedy Award nominated comic, Gemini nominated television writer, and CBC Debaters contributor and creative director for the Winnipeg Comedy Festival. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. And then I would also, just a comedy aficionado, you know, somebody who has really loved and craved this and just immersed myself in this art form long before I became a comic. It was an art form that I embraced fully. And, you know, it's amazing that we're talking today about somebody who is, incredible, you know, more studied, you know, as they say in books, you know, more studied than read. You know, and I would say that Lenny Bruce is kind of more remembered than heard, yeah. You know. A lot of people, we can dig deeper into this as we talk about the idea of a comic's responsibilities and also, you know, what or what not other people should say about comedy. We're living in a time very close to Lenny's, you know, where people are really interested in what comics are saying outside of the venues. In other words, people who haven't attended a show, listened to a record, watch a special, and so on, feel that there are limits to what should be said and can be said and in what context it should be said. And Lenny Bruce, if he's nothing else, has become an almost messianic figure in this discussion, whether or not he would have wanted to be or not, which we can also discuss my views on. But you guys today are talking about an album called Lenny Bruce at Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
You know, recorded in 1961. This is an interesting way to experience Lenny because it is an off-the-floor live recording.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you learn very quickly when you're exposed to Lenny Bruce is a lot of the Lenny Bruce material was released on a rather unsavory label called Fantasy Records, who recorded not just comedy but music. John Fogerty, most memorably, Fantasy Records, famous for suing John Fogerty for writing songs that sounded like CCR. Now, Lenny and there's also issues around whether or not people were being paid and properly compensated. The reason I bring up Fantasy Records today is that I think they do both a service and a disservice to Lenny Bruce, because Lenny Bruce was so like a jazz performer, so improvisational, so extemporaneous in his delivery. He never, and he says this in every show, he says in the Carnegie Hall show, never did the same show twice.
Yeah.
So what Fantasy Records did, and again, I would say to their clunky credit, is they would assemble the best version of a Lenny Bruce bit by taking little clips and pieces from a bunch of different recordings and putting them together. Right? Now, if this was to play together as a script or a transcript, you could really appreciate how great it was to see the development of Lenny Bruce's bits over time.
Yeah.
And unless you were teaching a class called Lenny Bruce Studies, to dig into every single version, recorded version of a particular piece, and then try to assemble in your mind how Lenny had developed it, would be very difficult to do. So for anyone that's interested in studying Lenny Bruce, you know, it's really, really quite crucial. And it's why I love the fantasy recordings. A piece like Comedian at the Palladium that developed over a certain amount of time, one of my favorite Lenny Bruce bits. Any little aside or little tag that he developed or crafted after he kind of developed the bit originally on stage is then slammed in using 1960s editing techniques. So the biggest problem, obviously, is the level of the background sound, mm-hmm. right? Every room is going to sound acoustically different. That you're going to interrupt and cut the laugh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just that the intonation of his voice, the way that he's delivering it within a sentence is never going to reconcile itself. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like a clunky, edited, monstrous kind of a thing. Very unpleasant to listen to and does not represent the rather fluid and free-forming rhythm of Lenny's style.
Yeah, it's like, but, yeah, if anything, like listening to his material is very jazz-like. It's very natural and flowing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But to me, it is also terribly important to have this because it does show how incredibly clever Lenny Bruce was and how able he was. And sometimes if I hear a concert, you know, because more and more stuff is coming out. The Berkeley show came out years ago. But, you know, I would imagine over time that people will find in a box, you know, an 8-track recording they've made of a Lenny show that, you know, will just be discovered. I'm hoping there'll be more and more Lenny Bruce material will come available over time. And then we'll be able to see more of these long and extended live performances. Mm-hmm. Carnegie Hall is probably Lenny Bruce, you know, just, you know, kind of right in the middle of, you know, his national prominence. He's playing an established kind of venue, Carnegie Hall. He even jokes about this. And it really does represent, in a way, a good quality Lenny Bruce show and gives you Lenny as he was, warts and all, for better or worse. And that's why it's a wonderful recording. Which I would say to most young comedians today and anybody exposed to Lenny for the first time, it's going to come across as somewhat disappointing and somewhat confusing. You're not sure what all the fuss is about.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's like my experience with Lenny Bruce was very different. Like after going back and listening to this, I came to appreciate him much more because in the context of how I'd listened to it before, it's like, oh, this just doesn't age well. It doesn't feel right. But then listening to like an unedited flowing of the bits and how he transitions and frames everything, it's like, oh, this works in this context way better than it did like in the context of these heavily edited, curated pieces of
music. Exactly, exactly. And it's interesting that you use that expression, age well, right? Because, you know, that's part of the conversation we're having right now, right? I mean, in cultural studies, right? And in on the internet, which is, you know, what does that mean from an artistic standpoint? What does age well mean? Age well means, I think, in the way you're using it, that at this particular juncture, which is not a fixed point in time, right? At this juncture, some of the material seems, and again, this is another temporal word, dated or whatever, right? And so there's a bunch of different ways that something doesn't age well. The style of the comedy, right? Literally, right? It is so predictable, like Milton Berle or whatever, you know, that we see the joke coming. That's one way something doesn't age well. It's unsophisticated in its craft. Mm-hmm. We have gotten better, right? The other, of course, is that it's too topical. And one of the things that's great about Google is that now we can take, you know, who was Bobby Franks? Well, he was the child victim of the 10-year-old, 11-year-old child victim of Leopold and Loeb in 1930s pair of thrill killers, as they said. And he makes this joke that in the show he alludes to it, that the kid was a little snot and so on and so on and so on. And so Lenny Bruce Eisenhower, you know, he's going to be talking about, you know, who the president was at the time and so on and so on. And in this case, Kennedy has just been recently elected. So there's that part of it is why it doesn't age well. And then the other is just the style of the comedy is doesn't age well. It's interesting, I would say, you know, who is influenced by Lenny, you know, in today's comedy world? Who is actually studied Lenny, listened to Lenny, and who can you have a conversation with about Lenny Bruce? And I would say back in the 80s when I started in the 90s, you could find a pretty large contingent of comics who were familiar with Lenny from cassettes and stuff. I would say that the most profoundly influenced comic that I know of, that I personally knew, was Mike McDonald.
Oh, okay.
Mike McDonald was profoundly influenced by Lenny Bruce. Mike McDonald's laugh, is Lenny Bruce's laugh.
Yeah.
Mike's extemporaneous delivery, especially, you know, because it's a matter of public record that Mike, for a while, was a heroin user. I think during that period, even more so when Mike would do shows back in the day when he was high. He was very, very much like Lenny, very extemporaneous, you know. I love one of the things, I'll be jumping all over the place like Lenny does. One of the things I love about Carnegie Hall is, like a jazz musician, he wants to find the time signature for the show, right? So right off the top, he's constantly doing a metronome, right? He's snapping his fingers after every joke. That slows down as he gets into his own rhythm. And some of the rhythm is based on the audience's perception, but I've never met, or reaction, right? But I've never met a comic, you know, discovered a comic who is less worried about the audience's response than Lenny Bruce. He doesn't seem to give a shit that, you know, and I mean, people appreciate it, but that, you know, it's they didn't think anyone was going to come in 61 because there was a huge snowstorm. But they ended up having a close to sellout crowd, I believe. That's not a sellout volume of laughter that you hear in the Carnegie Hall concert. No Lenny Bruce recording is ever going to be drowned out. You're never going to miss a Lenny joke because the audience is laughing too hard. Lenny never has to stop and pause because the applause break is so long, even when he's killing. Right? He's not that kind of a comic.
Yeah.
But it is amazing, right? And then the first couple of minutes of the album is he's riffing on, do they even know I'm here?
Yeah.
You know, do they even know I'm here? Is it? And I love the adjective he used, some corrupt janitor, corrupt, right? Like he took some money, you know, like a communist's rally or something, you know, just so amusing and so funny. You know, and then, you know, you see, he really establishes himself before he even gets into it. And then, you know, and very much in Mike McDonald style, the first 10, 15 minutes of a lot of Lenny shows, a little bit about what happened on the way there. A funny thing happened on the way to the forum, right?
Yeah.
Is what he does. Mike McDonald used to do that. Mike McDonald told me once, and I think it's so important for every comic, when you're doing a long show, is the pacing and the rhythm of a show.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Carlin was good at this too, and Billy Connolly, all the masters of, I would call, joke driven storytelling. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, and that is, Mike would say, when you get to the office, do you turn on your computer and sit down and start working for 8 hours at full potential? No, you have a coffee. Right. You go get a coffee. You chat to a couple of coworkers. First, it's about what you did the night before, how you got there, the traffic, the weather. Then very slowly, it's about the things that you're supposed to be doing that day. You start to organize the work. What are we going to expect? What's going to happen? What am I going to be doing today, right?
Well, there's that great interaction that he has between the person in the balcony. He's like, oh, can you hear me? And it's like, of course you can hear me.
We're in conversation.
You just want to be on the album. It's like, it's very natural.
And it's very natural and funny.
Yeah. It's crowd work without being crowd work. It's a genuine conversation.
Yeah. And I love when Lenny is surprised, you know, when he goes, you can hear me, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if Lenny's deliberately being slightly disingenuous, but he is directing, and he's even stepped away from the mic and is a bit louder. He's specifically talking to the man. That's why the man can hear him.
Yeah.
I actually believe, because, I mean, it's hard to handicap because you're not there, and obviously the mic is going right into the board, but, I mean, it's a very clean sound, right? I mean, you can hear everything on the album. I think probably what's happening is a lot of people are having trouble a little bit with Lenny's kind of with his idiom, with his accent, you know, his Five Boroughs kind of accent. Also that he speaks very quickly, you know, it's got kind of that Yiddishy driven kind of fast talking kind of thing. That if you're not following the sequence of the rhythms or what he's talking about, it's hard to follow.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, there's an almost precise analogy, which is that people say that Bob Dylan is incomprehensible in concert, right? Yeah. That he mumbles and you can't hear him. But I have, Bob Dylan to me is one of the most articulate singers that I've ever heard. He pronounces very, he uses very precise diction like Sinatra does. You can hear the T's and so on. When Dylan sings, Dylan is not a sloppy singer. It is simply that it's coming fast. It's not a predictable, I love you, you love me, you know, so you're not sure what he's going to say next, which is why both Lenny as a comic and Bob Dylan as a songwriter are interesting. They're not predictable. Right. And so that to me is probably the substance of why the person has a problem understanding. And Lenny actually addresses us later on in the record.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's a very good argument for against scolding and cancel culture is you can't be angry at somebody for not knowing what they don't know.
Yeah.
Right. If somebody literally doesn't get something, then there is some responsibility to explain it to somebody,
mm-hmm.
right? If you are, as Herbert Spencer says, displaying contempt prior to investigation, then you have a kind of a chosen form of ignorance, right? Okay. But if you say, I don't get this they, them, non-binary kind of garbage, right? It seems really confusing to me. Seems like a waste of time. And then somebody sits down and explains it to you, and you say, oh, I understand. And then someone says, let me explain to you, I don't want to hear about it, right? This is stupid, right? Those are two different things, right?
Patton Oswalt has a bit about language and that being an allyship, where he talks about wanting to not always being up to date on the terms.
Yeah,
updating himself as quickly as possible, and it's like give people a chance if they genuinely want to learn, and that's kind of the same gist. Whereas Lenny's kind of talking about, you know, his hip idiom and his Yiddish idiom and his intellectual idiom, and he doesn't want to have to pause to explain everything. So
and his Hollywood idiom.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, because I mean, one of the things that. You know, one of the things that we always have to remember about Lenny Bruce is that his condemnation of the entertainers, you know, as we see in the comic at the Palladium, you know, like the act Bingo and his dog, the sound check in the afternoon. Bingo says, what do we do when we see Hitler? Dog lifts leg, crash, right? That's the best rehearsal for that bit. So he's making fun of vaudeville, but in a way that is also full of a tremendous amount of respect and admiration. Because as you well know, Lenny Bruce begins his career as an impressionist, right? And so one of the ways that Lenny got to be an impressionist and I'm from this generation as well, is he would watch the things he loved over and over and over and over and over again. So these old movies, these old comedy skits, all the things that were coming into his life, you know, because he's right on the cusp of the invention of television, old school, old timey radio. And, you know, one of the things that you see very quickly when you're watching Lenny Bruce is how much he employs these kind of sketch, mm-hmm. almost Second City techniques. Hey, you wise guy. Yes, you bum. Yes, you schmuck, you know. I see ya. You know, it's very much in that kind of style, you know, doing Edward G. Robinson and, you know, people like Jimmy Cagney. Right. So he would stop doing the impressions, but he would do those kind of idioms and those styles. The wise guy, the gangster, right? The mall, right? He's really much, very much from that style, you know? And that's what also makes him fascinating and so timeless, you know?
Now, who would you say would be his comic? Because, I mean, he talks in the album about how he interacted with the earlier generation of comics, and they were, like, they were praising him for not doing toilet humor. But, I mean, he came up doing the burlesque circuit and as an announcer at strip shows and stuff. So he made this transition from very blue to very, very clean, and then rejected that, returning to blue material. So who would you feel informed his material during those early years?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I just want to jump in on that very quickly, which is that this was a trajectory that happened to Pryor as well, right?
Yeah.
Pryor tried to fit into the kind of white mainstream and then had that famous meltdown in San Francisco, right, where he went all homophobic on the crowd, you know, because he was so angry. Obviously, I don't think that the bisexual Richard Pryor was homophobic, but, you know, Richard dated a trans woman. But, you know, he was kind of fed up, right? He was fed up with that culture. He was fed up with slimy hypocrites like Bill Cosby, you know, condemning him, say why he had to use the language. He tried to play the game, and it didn't work for him, and he said, fuck it. And then he, you know, he became Pryor, and Lenny basically does this kind of the same thing. This is the era, of course, where there was a kind of moral panic around many cultural performance and, you know, just books and more famously comic books, Mad Magazine and so on. There was a moral panic going on, and there was a moral panic as stand-up began to blossom in this notion of the sick comic. Wayne and Schuster do a hilarious bit about how for the first time comedy records were outselling musical records. And so in one of the early Martin Wayne and Schuster albums, they have a list of all the top selling albums of the year. And one of them is the sick comedy of Marty Sick. So Lenny is in that kind of, you know, and this is at the same time, as you probably know, he's competing against Woody Woodbury, whose entire oeuvre was that he was an alcoholic, you know, one of the first comics to play in a room that was named after himself, you know, and then you have comics like Don Adams, you know, who was horrible, Soupy Sales, it wasn't quite as horrible. You know, all these kind of, you know, and of course, the amazing Bob Newhart and stuff, you know, but comedy was huge. And Lenny was put in this category of sick comics, along with Mort Saul, who turned into a reactionary kind of bizarro person at the end of the day, but also really borrowed on this kind of jazz idiom and style. Also, Mort Saul, a textbook homophobe and misogynist, as well as being in person a very disagreeable human being. But joke for joke, my goodness, and if you ever want, well, we could take apart a Mort Saul album, because I can quote, Mort Saul so often. My favorite Mort Saul joke that I quote quite often, because I think it's so important today, is Mort Saul describes how he was invited when Kennedy to the inauguration, and they were hoping, of course, that he would continue his shitting on Nixon. And of course, they didn't realize as a satirist now that the Kennedys were in power, he was going to shit on that. And it was the beginning of the end. That and his obsession with the assassination was the beginning and the end of his career. But at the time, he talks about how they land him in Bethesda, a naval base, right? And he's met by this five-star general, you know, who salutes him. He's got the epaulets and all the medals and stuff. And Marcel says, it's all terribly impressive if you're 11. I use that joke all the time because it's such a perfect gift of that kind of military industrial obsession. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned albums, comedy albums selling well. And in the special, Lenny references Von Meter, who prior to the Beatles was the highest selling or fastest selling album with his comedy about Kennedy. So you've met Meter.
I met Von Meter, and it's quite a story. My goodness. Okay. So as you know, poor Von Meter, right? And then it's often misquoted. But on November 22nd, 1963, Lenny Bruce has a show. And there's a question as to whether or not the show should go ahead and so on. And then it's an interesting product of how our memories were. For years, I told the Lenny Bruce Kennedy assassination night show joke that it was at Carnegie Hall. It wasn't until you asked me to do the show that I was reminded that the Carnegie Hall show was in 61. Mm-hmm. And so the show that Lenny does in November 22nd, 1963, is just a club show. But people are wondering why Lenny feels that he has an obligation, obviously, to say something. It's a terrible day, but the show must go on and so on and so on. And so he comes out and he whistles. You know, he does that Lenny Bruce whistle. And he goes, man, Von Meter is screwed, right? That's the actual joke. Some people say poor Von Meter. He may have done the joke again, like, you know, in other shows that week. But the first time, as far as I know, that Lenny Bruce references Von Meter and the Kennedy assassination and Stacey whistles and says, man, Von Meter is screwed. And of course, he was right. And so Von Meter. And so what happens to Von Meter is that Von Meter basically goes from making $1 million a year, $2 million a year, top selling comedy record. Was it called The First Family?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Until Von Meter returns and actually has quite a success with a follow-up album. I'm not sure if it's 1968, 1969-ish, about Nixon. Mm-hmm. So Von does a Nixon album, which isn't quite as good, but it doesn't sell. But he did a bang-on Kennedy impersonation. And so this is the early 60s. And then, of course, he has a little bit of a comeback in the 70s. But by the mid-1970s, Von Meter is pretty much finished as a, as a performer and impressionist. And I think by the mid-1980s, 1985, 1986, during the height of the comedy boom, Von Meter is in New York State somewhere, wandering around with no shoes, and he's addicted, or at least a heavily user of crack.
Oh, no.
Cocaine, yes. So quite sad. And then so now we cut to, I'm just trying to think now whether or not we had moved to Winnipeg or not. But somewhere between 1990 and 1994, John Oakley, huge comedy fan, and all-night talk show host in Montreal, has moved to Toronto and has this kind of show on one of those specialty channels, a kind of talk show. And it's just like John's radio show. He's some of his favorite people on. And so he invites me on to Spritz, and we talk about Lenny and do all the kind of things we always talk about. I read some of my funny poems and so on. Mm. The guest that night is also Von Meter. Wow. And so this delightful young man named Richard, who was both John Oakley's producer at CFRB and my producer at CFRB, one of these classic 1970s National Lampoon radio show kind of eager beaver kind of producer people that would do anything, kind of a, you know, a smarter Smithers with a backbone, kind of a young fellow, the smartest guy who was obsessed with comedy and would do anything for his host or whatever, drives down to the United States. I believe it's like Buffalo or maybe Niagara Falls, New York, where Von Meter is in a nursing home and is beginning to struggle with dementia to such a degree that he's not allowed out of the nursing home except for walks and visits to the library and so on and so on. And Richard drives down there, poses as one of his relatives with Vaughn's assent, right? Mm-hmm. And permission. And it says he's like a nephew or a cousin, going to take him for a walk. they spirit Vaughn across the border and drive him to Toronto, where he appears on John Oakley's show. And because he was on last and I was on first, he's in the dressing room when we arrive, and we get to chat for about half an hour about just that time, you know. And he's so full of amazing stories and stuff about that time. And then he goes on and does the thing. And, you know, I would describe it as very similar to if you ever watched that Paul Williams documentary, you know, here is a man. And then Paul even had the more, so, you know, Paul won an Oscar, Grammy. Paul Williams was a Renaissance man who lost everything. Von Meter, I don't think was quite in that talent caliber, but he was on top of the world. And like Paul Williams, he was a man that had come to a place where he had just said how few of us ever get a chance to have that kind of a success in what we love to do. How many nights and days of happiness, you know, and fun, how many people did I get to meet and so on. And this was his attitude, you know, that better to have, you know, loved and lost than to have never lost at all. And so he was this lovely, peaceful, gentle old man, you know, who was so kind and lovely. And, you know, he, you know, and he laughed. He said he laughed at the Lenny joke, and he knew it was true. And you know, he basically said, I thought of that long before Lenny did. And you know, I felt bad because you know, everyone loved the president, and everyone was in grief. But I'm like, what the fuck am I gonna do now? And I mean, maybe this is not a bad time to continue, and I don't want to do this that I'm name dropping, you know, but I happen to develop a friendship with Paul Krasner, you know, who's a very close friend of Lenny's. And both he and Lenny said that there was a guy in the neighborhood when they grew up that was even funnier than both of them. Yeah, I can't remember his name, but Goldman talks about it in Ladies and Gentlemen, Lenny Bruce, you know, that Lenny was hilarious, Paul was hilarious, but there was this other Jewish kid that was even funnier, and he didn't go on to show with us, you know. But Krasner basically co-wrote How to Talk Dirty and Influence People.
Yeah.
And if you listen to Krasner's comedy, you know, I believe that Paul, and he said, Paul would say this to some degree without taking any credit, that, you know, Paul was around for a lot of the development and Lenny versus bets and the conversations that Paul and Lenny had while Lenny was alive. There's no question that they helped shape Lenny Bruce and his material, you know, that Krasner's influence is kind of there. Although Lenny, I think at the end of the day, was a better performer, you know, than Paul. Paul was terribly funny, but as a stand-up, I think Lenny was the superior stand-up, as Paul would, I'm sure, attest, had he not recently passed away. So Paul had these lovely, beautiful stories about Lenny. But the most interesting stories I've ever been told about Lenny Bruce were actually from Tom and Dick Smothers, who I got to open for and also got to interview. And especially Dick would describe how different Lenny was from the Lenny on stage.
Yeah.
You know, that he was such a mensch, that he was so affable, that he was so shy. And Dickie Smothers, one of the most visually funny stories he ever tells is about taking Lenny Bruce water skiing. If you can imagine this skeletal, you know, white, you know, dark haired Jewish man in like shorts, right? Puffy shorts that are much wider than the diameter of his skinny legs, going around the harbor, holding on to this the bar that was the strangest and most bizarre thing, with the Smothers Brothers in a little speedboat dragging him around.
Actually, it was tying into what I was going to ask about. Like he, you know, he talks about his peers in the album, but he also operated as a mentor to a lot of comics. You know, interestingly, like Joan Rivers and Paul Krasner as well. How was his relationship with these younger generation of comics who, you know, idolized him, and like, you know, like Carlin and all these other comedians who seem to carry his legacy forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And I mean, Carlin's another good example. And Carlin is somebody, obviously, who was strongly influenced by Lenny Bruce. I mean, the difference between Carlin and some of the other comics that developed out of that style is that Lenny Bruce, like most, Lenny Bruce is by definition much more than any of the other comics we've mentioned today, with the exception of Paul Krasner. Lenny Bruce is by definition a political satirist, mm-hmm. right? And so Lenny Bruce in that sense is not necessarily a counterculture figure in that sense, right? That he is commenting on the status quo without really living in or offering alternative lifestyles that might be more agreeable to human cohabitation. You know, like Carlin, in the sense that Carlin was became a hippie, mm-hmm. right? And had Lenny Bruce lived beyond 1966, because he dies just before, right? Lenny Bruce, if anything, is from the jazz and beat generation, right?
Yeah.
The post-war generation, right? I mean, he wasn't born post-war, but I mean, he was coming out of that 1940s. You know, Lenny Bruce's cultural influences, you know, on his life and such would have been informed, you know, primarily in the late 1940s and 1950s, as opposed to the 1960s. Right, we're beginning with the publication of On the Road, A Catcher in the Rye. Certainly in poetry, we're beginning to see the development, the Howl, Allen Ginsberg's Howl out in California, The Hungry Eye. We're beginning to see the hippie generation develop. And certainly people smoked marijuana, but the idea of free love and all these kinds of things are a much later elaboration. Right, you know, the same way that Ken Kesey jumps on the Merry Pranksters bus, you know, but is still, you know, from that kind of a generation. Mm-hmm. Carlin, as you know, begins in a comedy team.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. With Jack Burns.
Yes.
Who ends up joining Avery Schreiber for Burns and Schreiber. So I think it was Burns and Carlin, or
they did the Playboy Club. I listened to that album
ago.
It's so different.
It's completely different.
The Wino Radio era.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
I came to know Carlin, but like hearing this, it's like, oh, this is almost like a Burns and Allen kind of.
Or Burns and Schreiber, right? Burns ended up going on and doing the same kind of thing. Not that Burns and Schreiber weren't funny, because they were. But yeah, so he starts in a comedy team. And then if you look at the early, you know, pre-bearded Carlin performances, WWINO, like he's very much like early Lenny, right? He's making fun of the button-down world, the radio announcer, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's really inured more in laughing, right, than it is in Fire Sign Radio or National Anthem Radio, right? We're at the cusp, you know. None of these guys came out fully born, right? They really were, straddling two worlds, mm-hmm. and eventually they would cross over into another world, which is what I resort back to, which is what would happen to Lenny after 1966? What would have happened if he hadn't, as Newsweek said, died of an overdose of police, right? What would have happened to Lenny Bruce? Would he have become like Mort, a grumpy reactionary? You know, or John Osborne, the British playwright, you know, Look Back in Anger became this conservative reactionary. I don't know what would have happened to Lenny. It's hard to say. But, you know, he straddles this. You know, he gets out in time. And then we develop this kind of comedy that really does become counterculture. A Cheech and Chong, right? The hippy dippy weatherman and stuff. And it really becomes inured in counterculture, marijuana culture, right? And it's basically don't trust anyone over 30, right? Screw the man, right?
Yeah.
Drop in, drop out, you know, take acid, all this kind of stuff, right? It's an anecdote to the culture. Is escapism, in a sense, political escapism, right? Because it's not ever going to actually transform anything meaningful. And then, of course, by the 1980s, a lot of them have moved into the tech world. You know, people like Wozniak and Jobs and all these kind of counterculture people are now getting into show business and kind of a in the bureaucratic and money making way, we get into this kind of yuppie kind of era, you know. And then the second kind of wave and comedy boom comes along, which I come out of, which is the sort of 1980s, right? You know, starting in about 1983, and then you just have this explosion of comics, and this is where we see the Lenny Bruce influence come back, but without the material. And I'm not, which is not saying that I don't think the comics had material. It's just they chose, for the most part, to observe things in society that were more pedestrian. Like, why is the pharmacist the only medical professional who's stands 3 feet higher than everybody else, right? Yeah. Which is one of my favorite Jerry Seinfeld observations, right? But we have Seinfeld and Reiser and Rich Jenny, you know, Jay Leno, you know, all the wisecrackers, you know, as I call them, kind of come out. And Rich Scheidner, great, great comics, you know, and I got to work with them all. And then slowly during that time, we begin to see comics come up that really are a bit more in the Lenny Bruce kind of vein of that era, you know, Kinison, Chappelle, you know, people like that. Kinison, very much in the Lenny vein as far as I could I can suggest. So I went on tour with my comedy team partner and Sam Kinison.
Oh, wow.
That was something that we barely survived, you know. That was a tremendous intake of hilarious showbiz anecdotes, right? Interesting venues, you know, playing O'Toole's Roadhouse with Sam Kinison, you know, where there's no stage, you know. Visiting Sam Kinison's brother, who's still a kind of an evangelical preacher who fires his gun into the air for Jesus. You know? And Kinison was somebody who was a student of comedy, you know, as a former evangelical preacher who realized that he wanted to preach, you know, as Jerry Lee Lewis would say, wanted to preach for the devil instead of the Lord, you know, and did, I think, like Jerry Lee Lewis too. You know, to the end, a tiny part of him actually did believe that there was some slim chance that he may indeed go to hell, you know, even though he didn't believe in it.
Yeah.
That to me was the beginning of the return to this type of comedy styling. And now we see a lot of comics that are kind of cut in the Lenny Bruce vein.
Yeah.
Chappelle being one. And then, you know, to a lesser degree, I'm not insulting them as comics, but to a lesser degree, really in terms of what they're talking about, not their quality of talent or anything like that. Bill Burr and Jim Norton and comics like that, the Australian Jeffries,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They're very much driven by point of view. Here's what I'm saying. Even CK to some degree. I would put CK in a different category because CK approached it. One of the things I would say that that CK did develop that was somewhat original, although other people did it as well, was this idea of rather than saying, you know, who are these ad wizards that came up with this, right? Who are these numbskulls? I could do a better job. CK's was, if I was in charge, it would be even worse, right? You know, that's the kind of approach he had, right? Who are we? I'm just an idiot. I'm just a slob. I have no idea what I'm doing. Why are you even listening to me? You know, this kind of idea. And then we have this struggle now between, public and private behavior. And also, I would say this new thing of punching up and punching down, mm-hmm. Right? And, you know, Lenny Bruce doesn't always pass the punching up, punching down test, of course.
Yeah.
But he's pretty good. His punching average is pretty good.
Yeah, like listening to this the album, like that was a problem with me early on. Is like it's without the larger context, and it was hard to contextualize it. But then learning that larger context, and it's like no, his punches were on the average, aimed the right way. And if they weren't, it was more like we said earlier, like he just didn't know yet. It wasn't a malicious thing. It was like, oh, he's got to learn, and then he adapts to that.
Lenny Bruce seemed to be a mensch. You know, I mean, maybe he didn't treat his, the people in his life that were close to him well all the time, you know, recovering alcoholic myself, people who are drug addicts are liars and don't treat the people that they love very well. And so obviously that dynamic, but, anybody that I've talked to knew Lenny Bruce said that he was a mensch with a heart of gold, you know, who really did care about people and in no way wanted to offend anybody but those who were oppressing other people. You know, his take on race is obviously very different, is very much of his time. And I don't think that we have the right to criticize or condemn it. He certainly had the approval for the most part of most of the African-American people of prominence in his day. And so that in many cases is good enough for me, you know. But he, it's interesting because Lenny was so profoundly intelligent. So when he says Bobby Franks, who cares? He was just a snotty little kid. He's really taking the position of Leopold and Loeb, you know, in a sense, right? And so one of the things about defending an intelligent comic is that you can use their intelligence to give them the benefit of the doubt in many cases. My fundamental issue with Dave Chappelle, other than that he punches down, is I am not sure that the way that he thinks about things and the ideas he puts forward in a kind of an evangelical fashion, where he says, you know, this is what's wrong with this, right? He's evangelical in that sense, right? He's one of these first-person comics. You know, Burr is the same, you know, and they'll retreat, you know, especially guys. They'll go, don't listen to me, right? You know, here's what you should do. Don't listen to me. Here's what you should say. Don't listen. I'm just an idiot. But here, do it this way, right? Is that I don't think at the end of the day that Chappelle is well-read enough or really takes in the whole view of the world. You know, as Wittgenstein says, the world is a collection of facts and an understanding of the world is to have all the facts. I'm not sure that Chappelle has all the facts, and that's fine. If you're going to play the devil's advocate, if you're going to play the wise fool, you know, but in a sense, don't talk about trans people if your ideas and viewpoints are not fully formed. If you want to fully form them and then come at it, then go at it, right? But to just kind of be on the surface and to actually make fundamental mistakes and logic mistakes. You know, I'm not here to unpack sticks and stones, but he changes the meaning of the N-word in that thing that everybody applauds, where she says, you know, you can't use the F-word because you're not an F. And he says, I'm not the N-word either. Right? The way that he says the N-word and the way that he's suggesting that she thinks that he is the N-word are two different definitions of the N-word. Right? And so he moves the goalposts intellectually. And fundamentally, I think, for the purpose not of being a poor debater, but for the purpose of making the best joke possible, Dave Chappelle makes that choice.
Yeah.
And as a comedian, that's the choice that he should make. Right? I am just saying that my preference, and all discussions of comedy really ultimately get down to taste preference. My taste preference is, if you're going to take an evangelical approach, then you drywall over any holes you have in your argument. So at the very least, I'm not sitting there condemning your argument at the same time that I'm trying to laugh. And I'm not going to laugh. I am not going to laugh categorically if I think that you're using disingenuous logic to make the joke, unless you're doing it just from you're being willfully stupid to make a point, right? Which is a perfectly okay comedy technique.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think that you want to have your cake and eat it too.
Well, with Chappelle, this triptych of specials that he's kind of done, it just feels like there's no progress from the first one to the third one in his point of view. Like he's maintaining the same surface, like you said, surface level understanding, and to the fact that he changed in like the second one in Equanimity, he literally changed the context of the core element because he's saying like he got this letter and it was from who he believes is a trans person, and it wasn't. It was a trans ally who identified as that, and he's like completely framing it so it makes a better joke, but you can't be a truth teller and a joke teller at the same time. You have to choose your hill.
In the Q&A of the show, if you watched in Sticks and Stones, he does the same thing with the trans woman he meets at the bar. And then he shows a picture of her at the end of the special. Did you watch that?
I had not yet. No.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're kind of off topic, but basically he plays the some of my best friends card.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is something he's in his career made so much meat from for the comedy sandwich when white people do that with color.
Yeah.
It's such a hypocrisy. And I think that's the key difference. Like Bruce never lifts himself up. He lifts society up with his comedy.
Yeah.
Chappelle is self-aggrandizing with his material. And that's, I think, where the difference in their voices come from, where they're working in the same mode, but completely different impact on me as a listener or viewer.
I mean, the first 2 minutes of comedy at Carnegie Hall is basically an unpacking of that. The first thing Lenny Bruce does, and when I reviewed the album, I couldn't remember everything about the album, so I was curious to see if I was right. And so when Don Feldman makes that pretentious introduction, you know, it reminds me of fucking when Bernstein throws Glenn Gould under the bus. I'm not sure if that was at Carnegie Hall as well, saying this, that the tempo in which he plays the Beethoven Emperor piece is not to his liking. It's the same kind of thing, except in the opposite. Feldman wants to mansplain to the audience who Lenny Bruce is. So I was much pleased that my memory served me, that Lenny Bruce shits all over it, right? I mean, he comes out and he makes fun of it right away. Yeah. And then he basically says, you know, he Lenny speaks to the crux of what's going on today and basically says, you should listen to me, right? You should listen to me is what Feldman is saying, right? I'm important. You should listen to me. And so he does. He unpacks that whole thing. He unpacks the apology off the top, because it is an apology in the argument sense, in the traditional sense of argument. He's making an apology for, you know, an advocacy for Lenny Bruce's style of comedy, right? And then Lenny he shits all over it. You know, you believe or you want to believe, you dig my show or you don't dig my show. And then he actually, and I think this is quite humane, is he makes a great effort to explain why you shouldn't shit on somebody for not having the context and so on.
Yeah.
And this is another important aspect of Lenny Bruce as an artist drawing outside of the lines, who was also, in a sense, apolitical in some ways, is he has the same obsession that Kubrick has, which is until the last minute when he was so struggling so much with his addiction and so overwhelmed and stressed out by his trials and tribulations, that in that concert film, which is still to me quite funny, you know, where he reads a lot of transcripts from the trial and closes with the Auschwitz poem. It's still worth seeing to me. It's still Lenny Bruce, and he's still quite funny. I laugh at that concert when I watch it every time. I still think it's Lenny. It's quite funny. It's great to see him. You know, ha, ooh, ah, doom, doom, boom, boom, boom. He opens the door and yells into the alley. It's got the Thank You, Masked Man cartoon.
Yes.
Which I totally love, right?
Thank you, Masked Man.
And, you know, so it's a great, artifact. Yeah, this idea of kind of being generous with the audience, and like Kubrick, actually being almost to the end extremely interested in being transmitting your ideas and being commercially successful for the purpose and measuring your ability to transmit your ideas through commercial success. Neither of them basically flipped the bird and said, if two people... You know, it's like an old joke. I can't remember who came up with it. You know, as I always say, if I can make just one person laugh, I'm not a very good comedian, right?
Yeah.
So Lenny Bruce was extremely interested in his audience enjoying the experience they had paying money. You know, he was not the cliche of a performance artist. He was like Kubrick. Kubrick was heartbroken when Barry Lyndon was a failure. Because he wanted to make movies that people saw and were shown on television. You know, that's why he filmed his films with the aspect ratio that would match television screen and so on. Lenny was very much the same. Lenny Bruce made great effort throughout his entire career to make sure everyone in the audience had the best chance possible of enjoying his ideas and his performance and his stuff. He put on a show. To me, Lenny Bruce put on a show till the day he died.
Now, you know, there have been a few portrayals of Lenny Bruce in the media, like Lenny and Mrs. Maisel. What do you think of these different ways that people have brought the myth of Lenny Bruce to other media?
All right. Well, let's start with Bob Fosse's Lenny. Mm-hmm. Bob Fosse, to me, made one of the finest films in American cinema, which is the film version of Cabaret. He also made the most pretentious, fascinating, and magnificent motion picture somebody has made about themselves, which is All That Jazz, which to me is also a masterpiece. He did, for very good reasons, decide in 1974 to make a film about Lenny Bruce, which he shot in glorious black and white. And cast, and you know, for very good reason, Dustin Hoffman. Mm-hmm. All I can say about the performance is that there are two performances, actually three, if I want to be kind of bitchy about it. There are two performances that demonstrate, without any argument, that Dustin Hoffman is incapable of being funny on film. One is Lenny. And the other is when he in Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
When every other actor, including Pacino, manages to be hilarious playing these kind of comic book characters, and Dustin Hoffman is mumbles, can't buy a joke. The third, and I have a fondness for the film, of course, is Ishtar. Mm-hmm. And the fourth, if I want to be slightly political and cranky, is Tootsie.
Okay.
I actually think he's pretty terrible in Tootsie as both a woman and a comedic actor. Mm-hmm. Dustin clearly, as a kind of method actor And there's the famous Laurence Olivier story, you know, about him staying up all night. And as a method actor, has clearly studied Lady Bruce, mm-hmm. right? It's an incredible impersonation of Lady Bruce, right? He can't buy a laugh.
Yeah.
If you watch, he does the material by rote, word for word for word for word for word. But he doesn't understand what the jokes are.
Yeah, it's just I watched it leading up to talking about the album, and it's like I couldn't buy his performance. It just didn't feel if he was saying the words, but there was no spirit behind it.
And but I have seen clips on film, and I can't remember where I retrieved them from, of Cliff Gorman doing the play, which is what the film is based on, mm-hmm. and Gorman was great. Right. So the play that the film is based on actually is quite good. And Cliff Gorman was great as Lanny because Cliff Gorman understood it. Mm-hmm. Poor Dustin just doesn't get it, you know. And so that's the biggest problem. It reminds me that I wouldn't mind seeing it again. It's not a very long film. And I mean, Fosse's mastery as a director is so good that it might be worth studying and watching. So it reminds me, I'm going to watch it. No, I'll watch the Lenny Bruce performance film right after. Yeah. But yeah, so that's not a good record. Only as someone obsessed with Lenny should ever watch the film. Mm-hmm. It didn't really do much to rehabilitate Lenny's career. Nor did it do much for Dustin Hoffman's career either. It was a box office and artistic failure. As far as the representation of Lenny Bruce in Maisel, I haven't seen the show.
It's as an impersonation goes, it seems to very much capture that mensch aspect of it, him as a human, that mentor and genuinely caring individual, and the like, there's recreations of his bits in the show where it's definitely method, but in the right way kind of thing, where it's like mimicking the cadence and the delivery and the style to the point where you get a Lenny Bruce performance without it being Lenny Bruce, which is interesting to me. Like you can watch them side by side. The performance is like the exact same performance, and the spirit, which Hoffman loses, is there in those moments when he's performing these bits in the show. So it's definitely worth checking out if you get an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll check it out. There was, I think I was going to tune into it, and then somebody, a prominent Jewish female writer, a longstanding New Yorker writer, took a takedown of it as somebody who was around in that time, just how it plays on a lot of tropes, both about comedy. And there have been very few films, in my view, that have really dug into the stand-up world and elucidated it in a way that is correct. I haven't seen the one with Mark Maron and stuff in the 70s. There's one called, there's one about a guy who lives on people's couches that's supposed to be good.
Crashing. Pete Holmes is basically
Pete Holmes' story. Show is supposed to be good. Yeah. So I wouldn't mind checking that out. I wouldn't mind.
Mrs. Maisel is definitely a myth. It's like the myth of the 60s comic. She's clearly drawing from she wore the dress Joan Rivers wore when she made her debut on television at one point. It's a love letter to a period of comedy that's not necessarily accurate, but it's well-intentioned. So it's that's our.
My God, Joan Rivers, you know, and I mean, if that's what had happened to Lanny, you know, not to be cruel about, I'm not talking about her surgeries and stuff, but just, you know, I mean, that film, that a piece of work, that marvelous documentary about Joan Rivers just reminds you of what a gutsy, you know,
hardworking, dedicated,
and physically appealing, and just, I mean, everything about her doing abortion jokes on the Tonight Show. Just, I mean, what a marvelous comic, and even so appealing in her not getting it, you know, so inured and just trying to go for the joke, you know, that our poor young staff is like, Joan, you can't say that about Michelle Obama. She's like, why not? There's something really appealing about it, you know?
Yeah. Now, just to wrap up, are there any last thoughts on this album or Lenny Bruce in general that you'd like to share with people?
You know, he didn't, he didn't write one-liner. So unlike Mort Sahl, you know, I mean, Mort Sahl has so many, you know, there's that. They tried to do this thing because Lincoln was a Quaker, or Nixon was a Quaker from modest beginnings. So they, when they were trying to make him more appealing, they had this thing where they were trying to basically say he was born in a log cabin like Lincoln, you know, and one of Nixon's flackies, like Haldeman, says, "You misunderstood. He wasn't born in a log cabin. He was born in a manger, right?" Which is a great one. I mean, Mort Sahl's joke about later, in the late 80s, early 90s, you can say what you want about Michael Eisner's time at Disney, but he made the monorails run on time. It's a great show. Yeah. Working with a comic, one of these hipsters comics, he wouldn't perform that night because it was Dave Brubeck's birthday. Playing in a small town and saying, where's the cool places to go after the show? And they took me to a place where you could fish illegally. I mean, so Lenny didn't have those, but he did have, a few. Be a man, sell out. That was one I always remember, Lenny. The setup to the comic at the Palladium when the Sophie Tucker sings all the songs, the heartbreaking songs from the war, and then this last song is for all the boys that went to war and never came back. Where are the boys gone? The boys are gone. And then the MC comes out. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Dean of Political Satire and Mimicry. And then he's got to come out to this thing and people are crying in the audience, holding each other, and he's got to do his thing. Oh, it's just so, it's so, so, so funny, But I would say that, I teach at the university, right? So we teach a lot of writers, And so I teach Gertrude Stein, for example. And Gertrude Stein is somebody who I would say is influential in some ways in the same way that Lenny Bruce is, right? That she was a discoverer. She discovered so many things and brought them forward. And maybe, at the end of the day to expose yourself to one aspect of her in its entirety becomes a little bit of an archaeological expedition at this time that you can't really maybe for the most part, especially when you're jumping in, enjoy Lenny Bruce as you might enjoy an old George Carlin record, or you might not get all the references, but you understand and appreciate why this was revered in its time. But also remember that as you listen to Lenny today, you're like 80% of even people that attended the shows, right? In that you don't get all of it. All I would say is, and I say this because I'm about to teach, I teach a James Joyce Ulysses class on Tuesday, and I'm about to do that again, is like Ulysses, Lenny Bruce is worth the investment. If you invest and you spend the time, Google references you don't understand, listen to his entire work, allow it to absorb, read about him, study him. At the end of the day, your investment in learning about Lenny Bruce as a comic will be well worth the effort. And he will teach you things about the craft. And in that way, Lenny Bruce will never get stale and will never get old and will never be not worthwhile or one of the most important figures whoever spent time in our industry and craft. It is really, really, really worth it. I don't know that this Carnegie Hall album is maybe the best place to jump in. What I would say is that post-transition, I have really stopped doing that kind of thing that really does, I don't like to do gendered cliches, but is kind of a dude thing, which is when somebody comes to you with a desire to learn about somebody that you basically say, okay, here's what you do. You start with Carnegie Hall. You listen to half of that. Okay. Then you listen to this piece called How to Impress Your Color Friends at Parties. Okay. Then you go back to the second track, right? You know, do it the way you want to do it. You want to listen to the Carnegie Hall album first. You want to watch the concert film first. You want to watch the Bob Fosse movie. I don't give a fuck. Just spend time doing it. Okay. I'll contradict myself. A good place to start, it's not all factually accurate, but he was around and he was a friend. Goldman's book, ladies and gentlemen, Lenny Bruce, is not a bad place to start. The other is the one with the CD on the back. I believe it's called Lenny Bruce on Trial. If you give me 1 second, I'll pull it from the shelf.
That is a tome.
This is called, I don't know how that works. Computers. Can you see any of that?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's called, just a sec here. Where are you? Okay. Oh, there we go. Okay. So it's called The Trials of Lenny Bruce, and it is by Ronald Collins and David Scover. And it's a very, very, very good book. And it also has in the back, or in the front, a 75-minute CD. And it's a well-written book. It has some new information that's not in the Goldman book. And just a second here, I'll tell you what's on the CD. CD track list, just a second here. So it's got the Steve Allen Show performance, you know, where he's doing the impressions and stuff, which is great. Then he's got, it's got all the famous bits. Thank you, Mass Man, Las Vegas, Tits and Ass. Then it's got Paul Krasner talking about him, George Carlin, Hugh Hefner, Margaret Cho talking about Lenny Bruce. It's got some of the stuff from the trial, a lot of stuff from, it's just a lovely compendium, kind of a university course, nicely written, very much in the style.
Awesome. Well, I'll have to check that out. Thanks very much. Now, if people wanted to see your work or see you perform, where could they find you?
Well, I live in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and I am doing a lot of kind of social justice stuff right now, and so I'm doing a lot of like fundraisers and these kind of things. I'm in the process. Pitching a show to a production company that involves me performing stand-up with some other comics. And so I'm hoping that may come to fruition. I'm interested in developing also some kind of a live performance kind of CD, you know, so that I can get some of the sweet, sweet serious money.
Yes.
But as you probably know, I left my gig at the Comedy Festival after 18 years. And so I'll never leave comedy, but I've just been focusing on a few other things right now, but I'm hoping to get back into it because I think it's a good way to express your ideas and develop them. But in the time being, you can follow me on, see, I'm a frequent guest on CBC, CBC's The Debaters, and they're all available online. So check me out if you wish.
Terrific.
I'm not as funny as any of the comics I've mentioned today.
I'm sure you hold your own very well.
Another comic that I who left us too soon that I thought was in the Lenny vibe was Patrice O'Neill.
Yes, yeah.
Patrice O'Neill was a terrific comic in the mansion, a very kind human being. And I was very blessed to spend a couple of hours speaking to him at Just for Laughs. And I invited him to the Winnipeg Comedy Festival. And very sadly, he died before he had a chance to come. Oh. As is somebody who I knew a bit better and also was a big fan of, who was Mitch Hedberg.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant performer.
I love Rice. Rice is great if you want 2,000 or something.
He just packs so much funny in such condensed, perfect one-liners.
There was a Hedberg joke that was very much in the Lady Bruce song where he said, I was in the movie Almost Famous, and I smoked dope. I smoked fake dope with Peter Frampton. I did that once, as opposed to smoking real dope with guys that look like Peter Frampton. I did that many times. I'm not in a relationship, but I live with a woman who will be very disappointed to hear me say that. Oh, bless him. I could do this all day.
All right. Well, thank you again for taking the time to chat with us, and have a great day.
Will you call me again and we can talk about Mort Sahl?
Sounds good. Sounds good. We will add Mort Sahl to the list, and we'll have a chat.
You know what we could do? We could do that era. We could do Mort Sahl and the Smothers Brothers, and I can regale you with the 3.5 hours I spent getting wasted with Tommy Smothers. It was a delight to talk to you, and I could do this. As I say to my students when I teach every class, I would do this anyway. I would just be sitting here in the kitchen doing this with my dog.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you, and I'll be back in touch again. We'll talk about Mort Sahl and the Smothers Brothers.
Excellent. Perfect. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
As I walked out in the streets of Laredo, remember that one?
Oh, yes.
I walked out in Laredo one day, I can see by your outfit that you are a cowboy. I see by your outfit you are a cowboy too. We see by our outfits that we are both cowboys. If you get an outfit, you can be a cowboy too.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.